Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, I'm Pippa Squatmas. I'm a professor at the Centre for Curating the Archive at the University of Cape Town. And I've been working with a particular archive, the Black and Lloyd Archive, for many decades. And this archive is at the centre of the book that José Manuel de Prada Sampa has written and that we'll be talking about today, which is Fading Footprints in Search of South Africa's First People. So, José, I just want to say at the beginning, this is a truly beautiful book. It's in part a memoir. It's a story of how you came to do the work that you did and the things that you discovered. But it's also quite a fine-grained piece of historical research in that woven into your own story is the story of the discovery of what your book cover calls the first people, the Cham, people who lived in the Northern Cape before, obviously, and during the colonial era. And your historical work is woven into your own narrative as a kind of journey of discovery. And you've drawn out a lot of features of that history from some of the more touching episodes in the household in which the interviews with these Cham took place. But you've also drawn out some of the more horrific incidents, the massacres and the tragic episodes in the story. You're a Spaniard. You've been educated in Spain and in the United States. You did your PhD. And yet you've sort of made your intellectual home the sort of bleak lands of the Karoo. So can you tell us a little bit about how you came to begin this work and how you would characterize this book as a result of what you've been doing?
Well, I came, as it's told in the book itself, it was very much by chance because I found the capital book of the Black and Lloyd collection, the Specimens of Bushman Folklore, which is it's a landmark in the history of South African literature and in the history of South African folklore. And I found the book in a Cambridge bookstore at a moment in which I was interested in folktales and oral traditions, because I had read in an essay by one of my favorite writers, Elias Canetti, that the writer in the process of his formation would do well to read myths and folktales and things. He calls them primitive peoples, but I think he never took that seriously. But he says these stories are always full of transformations. And I was gathering a little collection of books of folktales and myths, and I found that very attractive, because also physically, as you know, Specimens is amazing. It's a stunning book in its first edition. So I eventually bought the book, and it took me some time really to get into it. But when I did, it attracted me powerfully. There were many things that I couldn't understand, even of the stories themselves and how the stories had ended up in that book. But that was a stimulus for me to try to find out what happened. And as you know, that eventually took me many years later to South Africa, when I had already published a book of my own in which I included the stories from Specimens and from the customs and beliefs and even some unpublished material. Because, yes, eventually I got in touch with the librarians at UCT. I got in touch with you, with Jeanette Deacon. So, and then it became something very, little by little, I became part of a wonderful group of individuals like yourself, like Jeanette, that were also working in this, which I initially thought it was something quite outlandish for me to be devoting so much time to. It was I felt the company of others, and that was very important. And then, yes, I mean, I think we, over the years, we have been helping each other very much.
Yeah, I mean, we've had lots of late night WhatsApp conversations about small details in the archive and small discoveries and so on. And it really is, it's a collection that kind of grips one. You know, in the first place, you mentioned Specimens of Bushman Folklore, which was an extraordinary book. It was an extraordinary book to publish, for those who don't know, the stories of the Tham, edited by Lucy Lloyd. She and Wilhelm Blake were the two people that interviewed mainly prisoners, but also other people who were at the Breakwater Convict Station who came to live in their homes in the 1870s. But the book required a special type a construction in terms of printing the orthography and so on. And it is quite an extraordinary book. But at the same time, to come to it cold, it's in a way quite inaccessible. There's repetition, there's strange phrasing, there's ideas that are very alien. But, you know, once one encounters the actual notebooks on which these stories are based, and sort of drawn into the process of learning between the Tham and these two Europeans who were trying to learn their language. So when you came to South Africa, you had a slow discovery not only of the archive itself, but of the places. And, you know, we went on a couple of field trips, you went with other people. Can you just sort of describe the uncovering of some of the ideas that really come alive in your book when you were out in the Zaam country?
Yes, I am. Of course, the it was a fundamental moment in my road, in my path towards understanding and or getting a deeper understanding of this archive and the people who created it. When I came to South Africa, I saw the notebooks, the actual notebooks, which until then I knew only through facsimiles and also photocopies. I had gotten after getting my MA from Columbia University, I ordered a lot of photocopies of the stories. And so I knew only that, and it doesn't, I mean, that kind of reproduction doesn't do justice to the manuscripts. The manuscripts are richly layered. They are multicolor. I could realize also that there was a lot in the manuscripts that didn't show up in the photocopies. So that if you want to have a textual understanding of the stories as they were noted down there, you had to access the original, or as we have now, very carefully done and very high resolution scans, which then that didn't exist. So yes, and I came from when I was at Columbia University, I studied textual criticism, and it's something that I have introduced in my ethnographical research, so to speak. I mean, that how you edit such manuscripts is very important. You cannot do it haphazardly, or I mean, I have developed a method of doing that because I think in that way you get more details than you get if you like transcribe and edit at the same time. So that was very important. And then the of course the contact with the landscape was mind blowing. That is also described in the book because well, as you were mentioning before, the stories are very difficult to understand. They are extremely poetical, and but they have been translated following a method which I think we haven't just still sorted out how it was conceived, because it's not certainly what you find usually at that time. And so yes, I mean, and there are often elements in those narratives, even the ones which are explanations of rituals or beliefs, but when you go there, you begin to understand. That's what happened to me. I had this epiphany in the landscape, in the night sky, in the sunset, Yes, in everything. I mean, in those that absolutely alien territory with the brown stones and so on. I mean, and then I even in that first field trip that I did in 2005, I began to see to understand things, and I said, oh, I intended that trip to be like a one thing event. I wasn't really thinking of returning, but I returned the following year, and then every year almost since then, because being there, it just being there and having, of course, the stories in your mind, that was so helpful. I mean, you really, I mean, the things were happening in front of your eyes. The landscape was really alive.
So in your book, you describe many of these places that you're speaking of, and places where historical events took place that are detailed in the archive and elsewhere that you draw out in your book. And I think the value of some of that aspect of your research is humanizing the people who've been, for centuries known as the Bushmen. Here we have individual whose life stories we know. And I think you and I have discussed several times some of our favorite stories, some of the favorite, some of the things that have moved us most. And you've discovered details, for instance, of the story of Deat Quynh and the killing of the farmer Jacob Kruger. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about that aspect of your book, both in the landscape but also in the archive, in recovering that story.
Yes, the archive. I mean, for me, one of the beauties of what I was doing, I was compelled to do, because the stories were so beautiful, because the frame story of the Black family recording those narratives and interacting with those people was so amazing, so incredible. Is that yes? I mean, you get, yeah. It was something completely. Yes, you want to know more. You get into you find things, and then you want to get deeper and deeper. So what you have to do in it's to you have to get into the archive, you have to get into libraries too, because there are all those publications by Dorothea or by Black, the grammar sketches and the dictionary and this and that. You have to. I did also a lot of book shopping, and as you know, many of the books I bought initially were out of fetishism, but then I ended up using all that material. But then yes, so yes, that it was the landscape. You had to go to the landscape to understand. But then I had never done so deep, kind of deep research into archives. I really, it was kind of a formative experience for me. I mean, and then looking at those, how one would call them, judicial documents and court records and reports and things. I was amazed in some cases. For example, in the case of the killing of Jacob Kruger, the farmer, by Deat Quynh and his brother-in-law, Kassing, when I found the actual reports, which I think, I mean, not when I began with this, I did a version of that chapter in which I used what was then published. It was not much. And it was very disappointing. But then I found other references in the work of a historian, Afrikaner historian, I guess one could call him Brudik, who didn't know about the Black Collection, but gave a lot of archival references that I didn't know. And that was during COVID. And I asked a former UCT librarian, Sue Okhtarov, to go to the archive and get those for me. And when I got those, I was amazed that you could tell the story with so much more detail. And as you say, the people become human beings, especially when you also use the ethnographic material. We don't have, as you know, and the story of how Deat Quynh and Kassing were captured. probably out of I don't know. I mean, they didn't want to talk about it, or the blacks were delicate enough not to ask, as they had asked actually Cabo, who told about his capture and being brought in chains to Cape Town.
You know, for people who don't know anything about these stories, maybe you could just give us a nutshell of the Deer Coin story, and particularly what happened in the court, the judge's comments and so on.
What happened here is that Deer Queen and Cassin and his their extended families, they were camped at this place called Hifley in the western part of Bushmanland, and really not very far from Brantley, in what Ham called the grass country. And they were camped by a water source that locally is known as a Hora, which is actually a word that is in Dorothea Black's dictionary. It's water that seeps out of a rock. And then there were this family, also extended family, of farmers. They were on the other side of a big pan, and they didn't have very good water. They had salty, brackish water that was very difficult to get, as I learned from the farmer who owned Kifley at the time I visited there in 2006. So, yes, what happened is that, in my interpretation of the events, is that Kruger was especially unhappy, and probably his companions too, about that situation, that the which was highly unusual and very outrageous, that the bushmen had the good water and the farmers had very bad water. But they couldn't do much because Deer Queen and his brother-in-law, they had weapons. They were armed, and they were known, as the magistrate says later in one of his reports to the colonial office, they were terribly precise marksmen. So you couldn't just go and expel them. So and then at some point, that what the record says, that he went to the camp of the Aguain and Cassin, and they began to harangue them and say, you have stolen sheep from me. And I'm going to come with my friends, and I'm going to exterminate you. I think he used quite that word. It's in the records. And Deer Queen and Cassin got very frightened, because in that area at that time, that kind of threat you have to take very seriously if you were a bushman. So as he was, as Kruger, who then it seems he didn't have a weapon, was riding towards his own camp, because he felt also he was in inferiority of conditions, Deer Queen shot at him and hit him on the shoulder, and his brother-in-law fired another shot, and it hit the pommel of the saddle of the horse, and he could have lived if he could have arrived to his camp, but he died there under, it was summer, under the sun. I mean, possibly was a very, very terrible death. And then all the bushmen, of course, the Ham fled the area immediately. They left their dogs there. They left all that. And that's also another level of texture of detail that I found in those records, that not only court records, actually, there was some newspaper reports from people, local people who contacted or were kind of working for several newspapers and informed what transpired in the very remote northern border. And they left their dogs there, they left all their implements and things, and they escaped. And eventually they were caught, but it took the authorities some time to get them. So yes, there was that. That's essentially what happened. And then always the idea is that it was about stolen sheep, but I think it was very much about water and about people who were had weapons who shouldn't have them, and then they were occupying the water that should. Actually, by right, because it's you find that kind of rhetoric in the reports And in what was written after, know that these people felt they had been brought there by destiny, and that land was terrible, but it was theirs because it's God had brought them there. So the people who were there before, they better submit, otherwise they would be wiped out, which is what almost happened to them. So yes, so that was the problem, that those farmers were entitled to that territory, to that water, and they found themselves in a situation that was not the usual one. And so that story. And then you ask about the trial. That was one of the things I wasn't expecting to find when I was already had already worked the documents, the new documents that I had acquired. It occurred to me a way to search, because the UCT has subscribed to a database of 19th century newspapers, which is not terribly good because some of those newspapers, the sets are incomplete or are very difficult to read. But and so the searchers not always work. But I managed to find a very small report in a. And then yes, I found in a Dutch newspaper, the Zuid-Afrikaan, a very short report of how things had gone in court, which I think is in that specific chapter. That's probably my most substantial finding, because we didn't know actually what had transpired inside. And what had happened there is that the two brothers-in-law had a very good lawyer, Mr. Van Breda, about whom I haven't been able to find much more. And he defended them very well. And very soon, even the general attorney was telling the jury, if you feel that here is not murder, because the sort of the magistrate, the local magistrate, the Smith, had called what they had done cold-blooded murder. During the session of the trial, it transpired that it wasn't really that what had happened. Said, if you feel that this is a culpable homicide without premeditation, then you better turn up a verdict in that sense, not of murder. And the judge also supported that. So eventually, I mean, they got 5 years at the breakwater, the Equine and his brother-in-law. And I mean, getting that story in so much detail, even being aware that there's so much we don't know, that was very exciting, a very exciting part of my work in for this book.
Very exciting to read that too. And also, so lucky for us, because Dier Quain went and lived with Blake and Lloyd particularly, and gave us 3,000 pages of stories and material that survives now.
And in part we owe that to Van Breda, to the lawyer, who saved their necks. Yes,
their necks, and he gave us that great gift. But Jose, your book is not only about the past, it's about the present. And I think one of the things that, you know, is recognized and valued so much by those of us who've worked in this area is your work you've done amongst communities that live in the farm sort of heartland, as we call it. In small towns, in farms, often in very marginal communities, and you've been there. You've searched them out, and you've recorded stories. And maybe we can just sort of spend our last few minutes with you telling us a bit about that work, and also how those play out in your book.
Yes, that was a very unexpected turn in my research, in a research which had actually other unexpected turns, because I was convinced, I was seduced, I can say, by the story of an accomplished genocide of a people that had been completely wiped out. They were extinct. They were, survivors had been left, they would have been like diluted among the general so-called colored community, and so on. So yes, I was seduced by that, and I wrote that in my book of Spanish stories about the, I mean, ending with Janet's famous interview with that man at a farm, actually not far from Hifley, saying, you know, a phrase that he knew in Ham, which was, "Here come the farmers, let's escape." So that was very, very effective way of finishing the story. But then when I began to go in 2006 and I passed through those towns, Brandvlei, Kenner, Van Veeksvlei, and saw people also at the farms. I mean, the people there, they struck me as, I mean, yes, I could see in them the people that appear in the photographs that illustrate specimens of Bushman folklore. And I wonder if really there had been such an extinction, I mean, physically at least. I mean, I said maybe I was at that point pessimistic and thought, yes, they culturally, surely they are extinct because so the suffering was such, the genocide and the persecution was so terrible. So I, when I decided at some point, well, it's, let's try to do some interview, even if we only get oral histories about that suffering, that marginality, it's worth preserving the memories of the people who most likely are descendants of the ones that gave us the story. So I was surprised when, well, first in an interview with someone, you know, Maria Captain, that yes, I got stories about the water snake, and also some very gruesome personal narratives of suffering as a child from one could call a dysfunctional father, and then alcoholism and so on and so forth. So I was getting what I was expecting I would get, because also I knew from, there was another researcher before me, Ansi Hoff, who had documented the water stories. So it was in Brandvlei when I interviewed two sisters, Katrina Swartz and Magdalena Biukis, who unfortunately we lost her to COVID. And they began telling ghost stories and so on. And then eventually they, I mean, someone said, "I'm going to tell the story." It was Magdalena said, "I'm going to tell the story about the Oma and the lion." And yes, I record, because I had done my thesis on the lion stories of the farm. And I had recorded some stories that really are not among the better known ones from the collection. So I recognized that story almost immediately. I was absolutely astounded to hear that story, even if it, in a very transformed way, from someone that was sitting in front of me. And that started, you know, another line of research of recording the oral histories, the folklore. And it, there is a lot of folklore, actually. And I mean, at first I thought maybe this is an isolated case, because that extended family, the Fan Sales, they are very exceptional people. They are very aware of the importance of the heritage they carry, both the stories and the real dance and so on. So, but then I, as I began doing field work and interviews on other areas, I found many of the same stories. And then eventually they turn up, many of those also farther south in the Cederberg, where one wasn't also supposed to find them. So that, for me, that ended the tragedy, because I was living this, no, it was a weight I carried, the extinction of the people, the disappearance, the silence, and so on. And but then suddenly they were in front of me, and they, and that kind of, yes, it changed the whole view I had of my work and my research.
And those stories are really beautifully told in the book, and you introduce us to some of the characters and the very sad stories of their life. I mean, I recently spoke to Maria Captain's daughter, who's also Maria Captain, and she told us some more about the, you know, the sadnesses of her mother's life. But as you say, you have managed to draw out some of the stories that you know are the threads that connect them and us also to that bigger past. So unfortunately we've got to the end of our time, but I just want to say that this again is a truly beautiful book. You know, for those of you watching this, it's a touching story. It's a moving story. It's a sad story, but it's full of very rich detail. And I hope everybody will go out and buy it. It's available in all the bookshops in South Africa, I think, and probably online too. So, Jose, the next book, what is that going to be about?
Well, I would like, there is some archival stories that I couldn't include in the book that I would like to work on them, especially stories that have to do with the stolen children, which is a subject that runs through the book. As it runs through South African history, as it is seized, I mean, the people, children who were survivors of commandos and were raised by farmers as servants. So I have some oral histories about that, and I have archival material about that, and I would like to tell that those stories and other stories of things that happened in that area, in some cases to people who were related to Cabo. And then I also, as you know, I'm fascinated by the figure I call the Master Otlo, the trickster of the contemporary Afrikaans-speaking rural communities in South Africa. I think not only in the Northern Cape or in the Western Cape, Dirk Lichter, Jan Thomas, and so on, who is, I think, this is the modern day avatar of the Mantis, the trickster divinity of the Ham. And I would like to publish a collection of those stories, because I think that is the greatest creation of the minds of the people now living in those areas. In the Cederberg, in the Karoo, in the Northern Cape. So I would like to do like a study of that figure and a collection of those stories, which are amazing, stunning. So that would be the two projects.
Well, let's hope they come past soon. Thank you very much, Jose.
Thank you, Pippa.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.